with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Felt the understanding that I'm not doing a bad thing, I'm doing the right thing, was so important, and it felt like that the whole way through.
Today, we're airing about post-Roe abortion access, produced by our friends at the Response Podcast. Since the loss of federal protection, access to abortion care has become more difficult, especially in the South, the Plains, and the Midwest. But the movement for reproductive justice has only strengthened. Today, we hear about mutual aid efforts to connect folks to medical abortion and emergency contraception. But we also acknowledge that reproductive justice is about more than abortion access.
Well, we want to build out a farm for sustainable food. Do y'all really need to do that? Like, what's that got to do with abortion access?
Stay with us to hear the answer to that question, but first we're going to Florida.
Okay. My name's Angel Jones. I'm a 28-year-old mom of two, a stay-at-home mom of two. I feel like the conversation about abortion is pointed in a lot of incorrect directions. I think a lot of times, especially when you get down to the nitty-gritty of arguing why it's so important, people will, you know, throw out things like, well, you're irresponsible, or, you know, it's your fault, so take responsibility, and this kind of thing, in order to muddle it down into, I would say, just get dirty with the way of dealing with abortion instead of looking at it as a human right, which is what it should be. So I've been with my husband for 10 years. And in the year 2020, I believe it was December 2020, I found out that I was pregnant. We already have two kids, both who are on the autism spectrum. One who is more severely autistic than the other. And this was a very chaotic time for my family. We were pulling it together and we were doing really well getting them services. And then, of course, it was like, boom, I'm pregnant. And I remember thinking, you know, I was happy at first because I'm with my husband and we wanted more kids, but then realizing how difficult the situation would be to continue the pregnancy at that time. So it was a really big decision that we talked about for a couple of weeks, and we decided it wasn't the right time to grow our family. And so I began the process of looking into abortion clinics locally. And that process was extremely scary. Not just the process of okay, it's going to be a lot of money, but pulling up to abortion clinics, there are people screaming at you, taking pictures of your car, just making a really difficult situation already much worse. And once we got through that, after finding out how much it was, I was shocked to hear that an abortion where I think I was at 6 weeks, I was really early, and they were saying that it would be $700, and if it got up to 9 weeks, it would be $8. And there were some funds to help people who needed help with the money, but they were only available to women who had jobs. Like, you had to show pay stubs to get the discounted rates. And I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, so I had no options when it came to that. And I remember just feeling, sorry. I just remember feeling like, if I don't scrape together this $800, then it's going to be thousands for the next 18 years when I already had two kids who really needed me. And I went home, you know, wallowed for a little bit, and I thought, this cannot be the only way. And so I started to research, you know, like, how do you do an abortion at home? Is there any options for online pills or things like that? And I remember being terrified because I was just, I'm like, this is completely uncharted territory. I had never seen anybody talk about mail-in abortion pills ever. And it was just completely new. But I researched, I read every single forum I could think about. I read every single article from even like the right-wing people saying that this is going to kill you. And the people who are saying this is important, tell more people about it. And I stumbled upon Aid Access.
Aid Access is a nonprofit which was started in 2018 by Dutch doctor Rebecca Gompertz. It consists of a committed team of doctors, activists, and advocates for abortion rights who provide abortion pills by mail. Dr. Gompertz also founded Women on Waves, an organization which employs vessels to travel the world providing abortions in countries where the procedure is illegal. She's estimated that through her various efforts, she's been able to provide around 200,000 to 300,000 people with abortion services worldwide.
And so I started to narrow my search to just about who's used Aid Access before. And I saw a few here and there saying like, yes, it works, it's fine, it's safe. But still that fear was there. But because the situation was so dire and I knew that this was the only way that I would be able to afford an abortion, I went ahead and I went through their process, which is a screening process first, and they ask you to, you know, provide a name, an ID. If you can offer an ultrasound, they ask for that. You know, they ask if you need help with the money. And at that time, they were charging, I believe it's 105 euros, and that's $95 in US dollars. And after I went through the process, I paid, and I was sent the pills in about 2 to 3 weeks, somewhere around that range.
After receiving her abortion medication in the mail, Angel was able to successfully go through with her self-managed abortion at 8.5 weeks into her pregnancy.
So I think one of the scariest things about self-managed abortions is that you're going through something that feels like, you know, medical and scary by yourself. And they do cover that in the screening process. They do say, you know, if you feel like something is wrong, go to the hospital. They can't test you for these pills. You can't be charged in certain states. And they let you know what states are, you know, more strict about these kind of things. So I think it's important to talk about that part. And I think that as women, it's already a process that's hard. It's already a very nuanced situation for anybody choosing that. And to have the idea that you may actually have to face criminal punishment for making this decision that's difficult anyway, but that might be better for you. I feel for every woman in a state like that because it really is terrifying.
Medication abortion, better known as abortion pills, was first approved by the FDA in the year 2000. It's extremely safe and effective for pregnancies of less than 12 weeks. According to Whole Women's Health, the FDA-approved regimen for medication abortion consists of two medications currently available by prescription. Mifepristone, which works by blocking progesterone, a hormone needed for a pregnancy to continue, and misoprostol, taken 24 to 48 hours later, which induces contractions and ends the pregnancy. A person's ability to self-administer mifepristone and misoprostol after receiving instructions from a provider is well established, and it's been proved to be safe and effective for someone to do so without medical supervision.
I've done a lot of research about it before, and even after I've used it, I've seen the doctor, I believe her name is Rebecca, who has really championed for this to keep running. And I'm not sure if that's exactly the definition of mutual aid, but this woman, she has fought with the FDA to be able to send her pills into the USA. She's won. She's still able to keep doing it. And on top of that, just the way that they handled the situation, everything is handled very gently for the people dealing with it. And even when they thought that I might not be able to pay, they were like, okay, well, we can knock the price down again, you know, like whatever you need. And I just felt the understanding that I'm not doing a bad thing, I'm doing the right thing, was so important. And it felt like that the whole way through. And I've tried to tell people about it if they ever ask me about it, because I think that this should be available more widespread and should be talked about much more. Because I believe that is what mutual aid is, what she's doing.
So today there's three of us from Gulf South Plan B, three collective members from Gulf South Plan B. We all live in South Louisiana and have a variety of backgrounds. We all have been involved in abortion access work and practical support work in some way, shape, or form, but each bring different experiences with disaster response or language justice, disability justice, harm reduction. And so, yeah, there's three of us here today.
Gulf South Plan B is a small collective that provides free emergency contraception, primarily by mail, to anyone who requests it. They asked us to remain anonymous for this story. Emergency contraception, known colloquially as Plan B, is still legal in Louisiana. These pills are not like the abortion pills provided by groups like Aid Access or Just the Pill, who we heard from in part one. They don't induce abortions, but instead prevent pregnancy by delaying ovulation. Pregnancy prevention is an extremely important part of reproductive health care, and providing access to this kind of contraception is part of a broader reproductive justice framework. Especially in states like Louisiana, since Dobbs, abortion has been almost entirely banned in Louisiana, with very few exceptions. And like most other states with abortion bans, Louisiana criminalizes the procedure and prosecutes providers. Doctors and others can face up to 15 years in prison if convicted.
So I think when you're looking at the landscape of, you know, any particular state or region or city, their reproductive health rights and justice landscape, there are a number of roles that individuals and organizations can fill, be it abortion funding, be it practical support, be it clinic escorting or defense, be it emergency contraception provision. There are a diversity of tactics and many different needs that, you know, any group of people can come together to commit themselves to provide or needs that they try to fill. For us, we had laid the groundwork for providing emergency contraception in this way really about a year ago and had worked to create a project that would feel sustainable and responsive and then soft launched, if you will, not too long before the draft leaked for the Dobbs-SCOTUS case. So for us, there are many ways that people can meaningfully engage with the, you know, support of reproductive choices of their community members, and emergency contraception is one, you know, one of many ways that people can support one another, both in a pre- and post-Roe world. So there are financial barriers to accessing emergency contraception. It can often run $40, if not more. There are logistical barriers to accessing emergency contraception, especially if you're in a more rural area, having access to pharmacies. And so people having just one more tool in their tool belt available to them in the event that they may need emergency contraception or someone that they know or even care about may need emergency contraception is just one of many ways to help keep one another safe.
There were always barriers before. People had to travel. I mean, we mentioned there were three clinics in Louisiana before. The vast majority of people in Louisiana do not live in one of the areas where one of those three clinics was located. So people were already having to travel and arrange for overnight stays and childcare. And that's just, that timeline is extended now. People are going farther, they're traveling for longer, the costs are higher, the barriers are higher. That's the thing that's changed as of right now for people that do put together the ability to travel, whether that's through external funding or borrowing money from friends or family or putting off other needed bills or payments. And the other thing that's changed that's really big, obviously, is the criminalization, potential prosecution. It's just dangerous in a very different and bodiless way, if that makes any sense. It's not a type of danger that a lot of people understand, especially now that so many people are using the internet, using Google to try to find resources. We've already seen one case in a different state where messages on social media were used to prosecute somebody. So that is a little bit of a whole new world. And I think that's going to be really difficult moving forward.
There's been a growing movement to protect online privacy, particularly in our new post-Roe era. For example, led by the Alphabet Workers Union, more than 650 Google employees have signed a petition demanding the company protect the location and browser history of people searching for content and information about abortion from law enforcement agencies. And Google Maps has agreed to delete search histories when people visit abortion clinics. Of course, this kind of pushback is not nearly enough to protect people, but at least it's being talked about. Gulf South Plan B also provides bulk amounts of emergency contraceptives, or EC, to community partners for distribution throughout the state of Louisiana. They also maintain a small stockpile of emergency contraception to distribute in the event of climate disasters such as hurricanes.
A lot of the shape that our project takes right now has been supported by our friends and comrades with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. We spent quite a bit of time in the weeks and months following Hurricane Ida, quite a bit of time in our regular supply distribution work across Plaquemine Parish, Terrebonne Parish, Orleans Parish, providing not just tarps and roofing nails and water, but also having alongside that emergency contraception, pregnancy tests, menstrual supplies, and having all of those supplies available in the same Penske truck, if you will. So it's just as normal to say, yeah, you need gloves and tarps and water. Do you also need emergency contraception? Does anyone in your house need emergency contraception? Do you need Narcan? Does anyone in your house need Narcan? Explaining to folks in an extremely destigmatized, on the ground, face-to-face way, how EC works, how it is not an abortion pill, and just having all of these supplies be provided in just in the same breath, in the same truck. It's just as normal to grab, mold remediation supplies as it is to grab, emergency contraception for your household at this time.
In the web space that we've been occupying, we do have an option for people who fill out our request form to talk about other types of services that they would be interested in, whether that be more information about pregnancy options, whether that be creating a small distro hub where they live. We're open to taking any kind of feedback and advice and requests from people about the services that would be most impactful for them when they reach out to us for Plan B in the mail. So we're very interested in being elastic and kind of growing to fit the shape of people's needs.
We firmly believe in everything for everyone and people having access to all the things that they need to have not just their basic needs met, but for themselves and their families to thrive. One of the perspectives by which we approach the work that we do here is that we as a small group of volunteers are committed to providing one piece of that puzzle. And part of the possibility, the potential, the joy in building power across a region, across a state, through intertwining movements, is knowing what it is that we can provide and what we can offer to people with confidence and sustainability, and then to find and to continue to rejoice in all of these new emerging ways to sort of marry our work with others. And sort of through that perspective, build a more robust mutual aid movement through principles of solidarity and dual power.
I mean, I just think that we need to think about mutual aid in a more broader sense.
Here's Lori Roberts of the Mississippi Freedom Fund, who we previously heard from in part one of this series.
I know when we bought the Fun Check, if no one has ever heard of us before, we bought a building. We bought a trap house, okay? We bought a trap house that's, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and it has like a back apartment that's another 1 bedroom, 1 bath. And I really bought it because I was like, well, we can use it for so many things. But then I also, when we were designing like how we were going to put in, what kind of furniture we were going to put into it and how we were going to design the space, like every room has extra sleeping space in it, built into it. Murphy beds, hideaway beds, whatever. And I remember people were like, what are you doing? What is that about? And I said, all I'm going to tell you is I moved to Jackson in 2005 and Katrina hit. And everyone from New Orleans came to Jackson. Every time there's a hurricane on the coast, people come to Jackson. And all I know is if there is something that happens and our activist folks have to come to Jackson, I want us to be able to be a base for evacuation for our people. We may only be able to house 10 people, but let us be able to house 10 people. You feel what I'm saying? Like, let us be able to house 10 people and hopefully have our own electricity and maybe our own rainwater collection. You know what I'm saying? And be able to hold down our folks for like a little bit. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about, is like, it can't just be, oh, well, we got some food at the last minute to hand out. Like, we have to be thinking broader. And I don't want to sound like doomsday prepper, like progressive person. But in all honesty, Jackson goes through boil water alerts all the time. We go through issues with infrastructure all the time. And it's just something that I've been thinking about broader often. I think about it a lot, about how not just for our org, but other orgs, that mutual aid needs to be thought of in a much broader, like, what are we doing to build our infrastructure, our community building, our education networks within our mutual aid networks and bases to be more sustainable versus reactive.
In fact, Jackson just experienced a boil water alert this summer when tens of thousands of residents went without water for 2 to 3 weeks. Many organizations stepped in to fill the very deliberate gaps in support left by the state of Mississippi, delivering water and providing resources for residents of the state capital. Lori has been distributing water in Jackson every day since the 2021 water crisis, when the city's water system failed for over a month. She's been a vocal critic of what she refers to as a state of willful neglect in the majority Black city, which is not just limited to boil alerts, but also to lead contamination in the water. Rather than just responding when there's a crisis, she's been involved in efforts to build sustainable water resources in Jackson for years.
I mean, like, I live the connections, right? Like, as a disabled activist, and, you know, as a disabled femme, you know, non-binary person who lives in the South, like, but I was born up north, you know, like, I carry a lot of identities. And then also, I've lived in different places. I've had a lot of different experiences, and I just try to see things from a lot of different perspectives, but also keeping in mind who we should be centering, which is not the people who are normally centered, right? I'm not here to center, you know, the people with the most money, the people with the most access, the people with the most resources. They don't need me to center them. They're already centered 365 days a year and 24 hours a day. So I don't need to center them and their needs. I'm here for the folks who are in my community. And we like to say at MRFF, like, we, the kind of feminism and reproductive justice that we do, you know, we here for the baby mamas and the scrippers and, you know, like, the sex workers and the drug users and the folks that people don't care about, you know what I'm saying? And the foster kids who have aged out of the system and the houseless folks, you know, and the people who don't vote because they're disenfranchised, the people who don't vote because they don't think they should vote. You know what I mean? Like, the people who feel like they don't have a voice, and the people who just are too tired. You know what I'm saying? Like, the people who are tired, they're just tired. We hear for all of them folks, right? That's who we ride for. The other folks don't need us. They don't need us. Like, that's who we are.
Here's Golf Plan B again.
As a small group of people, we bring something that is, like, at its face, honestly, just so simple as just acquire Plan B, distribute Plan B, two thumbs up, yay. you know, all of these lessons that we've learned either personally and intimately through so many of us being born and raised in South Louisiana and through our respective movement work and organizing work, learning over and over and over. I'm avoiding anything that smacks of a resilience narrative here, but, you know, learning over and over and over that what we have is each other and we have everything that we need. And, you know, whether it is providing tarps and roofing nails, whether it's organizing mucking and gutting crews, whether it's providing Plan B, whether it's fundraising to pay for someone's abortion, whether it is, you know, any of these things, we are living not just through a series of acute crises, but we're living under the crisis that is capitalism. We are living under the crisis that is white supremacy. Or we're living through the crisis that is never-ending climate disaster. And the tools that we learn from one movement, that we hone in one movement, they are not only easily translated, but, like, naturally translated across many. And what makes a project like providing one specific thing like Plan B, in my perspective, powerful is when we put it in conversation with what other folks are providing and to whom. And that's how we create an ecosystem that can keep each other safe.
sometimes it's very hard to get that through people's heads. When I say, oh, I want to go buy a bunch of stuff from the dollar store, oh, that's okay. You know, like that's a charity mindset. The acceptable things that like low-income people should have, right? But when you try to get people to reach for more than that, where it's like, well, we want to build out a farm for sustainable food. Do y'all really need to do that? Like, what's that got to do with abortion access? Well, it's not necessarily about abortion access. It's about reproductive justice, which has to do with all of those things. Like, how do you have a healthy pregnancy if you can't have food access? How do you have healthy children if you don't have food access? When I talk about why we need solar panels on our property, right? Because we have bad infrastructure in the South, and why it matters for us in a place where there's constant infrastructure issues, why it matters for us to be able to be a hub in our community of power, especially in a place where there's high asthma rates, people need to have access to being able to use a nebulizer, stuff like that in the middle of an emergency, even if it's a small spot. Some people get it and some people don't.
This is just a beginning of an extremely violent, heavily surveilled, like reproductive carceral landscape. And at the same time, our work, and I say our in the most like broad sweeping way, our work is extremely cut out for us. But that also means that it is a new beginning for the ways that we learn, dream, create, and protect together.
Yeah, well, I'll say that Southern ingenuity and Southern innovation and Southern resilience gives me motivation. Like my father, I say this all the time, but people are probably tired of being like, Lori, shut up about your daddy. But real talk, my dad was born in 1936 in Blount Springs, Alabama. My grandparents were born in 1905. I just think like folks who came through all of that, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I think we can power through this. You feel me? I mean, my dad survived sharecropping, you know, and my grandparents survived the Red Summer. You know, I just try to put things in perspective. I'm not saying that we aren't going through some really hard stuff. We are going through some really horrible, horrible, horrible things that are our own horrible struggles. I just think that, like, we shouldn't have to persevere. We shouldn't have to be resilient. We shouldn't have to lean on that legacy. But we're here now. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm tired of having to be like, oh, we're resilient. Like, I'm over it. I just want to, like, luxuriate in Black joy. Like, that's what I want to do. What I want to do right now is be like, oh, let's be all about Black joy and POC unity and, like, build some of that. Like, but instead, we got to do all this crisis mode stuff. But that's cool. We can do community building while we do that. And that makes me hopeful, too, right? So, I mean, there's always room to build and grow in crisis. And that makes me hopeful, too.
Stonewall Inn was a popular gay bar, somewhere where people felt accepted and safe. But on the morning of June 28, 1969, the bar was raided by police, forcing over 200 people out of the bar and arresting 13. The raid was the latest example of constant discrimination faced by LGBTQ people, setting off a riot involving hundreds. The Stonewall riots lasted several days and are known as the catalyst to what is now known as Pride Month. In recognizing the ongoing fight for equality, KPFK celebrates the opportunity to wish everyone a happy Pride Month, knowing that together we can work towards a future where LGBTQ individuals feel accepted and celebrated for who they are.
Okay.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin.
In honor of Pride Month, we have a special show for you this week featuring two stories from our archives. We'll hear about a pivotal moment from queer history, the Stonewall Uprising.
When you think of pride, parades and parties might come to mind. It might be hard to imagine that the worldwide LGBT celebrations were sparked by a neighborhood uprising in New York in 1969. But how many of us really remember what happened back in 1969? On today's show, we'll hear about the day that galvanized a generation and the continued fight for LGBT civil rights. I'm Laura Flynn, and you're listening to Making Contact. The first Pride parade took place in June 1970, marking the first anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. Michael Shirker brings us this oral history, remembering Stonewall, the birth of a movement.
In 1969, the Stonewall was one of the most popular gay bars in New York City, and, like all other gay bars, was routinely raided by the Vice Squad. The patrons of these bars, many of whom were frightened at having their identities revealed, would quietly submit to any orders coming from the police. Yet, on June 27th, 1969, that all changed. The patrons of this bar, with the drag queens at the forefront, decided to fight back against the police. What happened here on that night would spark a revolution.
I'm Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
He also would like to know what your age is. So
my age? 78? Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you touched me, when you took my hand, something happened I had never planned.
Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as straight as possible. The general attitude of society as far as employers were concerned and landlords, all of these people were very hostile, and to protect ourselves, we had to act as rugged and manly as possible.
Name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police.
My name is Seymour Pine. In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the first division in the police department, which covered South Manhattan from 38th Street to the Battery, including the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality.
My name is Red Mahoney. I've been hanging out, drinking, partying, and working in the gay bars for the last 30 years. In the era before Stonewall, all of the bars, 90% of the bars, were mafia controlled. They were controlled because the mafia had the right connections. There wasn't that many gay bars. You'd have maybe one, two uptown in the Upper East Side, they would get closed down, and there'd be one or two on the west side. They'd get closed down, and midtown there'd be one, two, three, maybe open. As they would get closed down, they'd move around, and they were dumps.
I'm Joan Nessel, co-founder of what is now the largest collection of lesbian culture in the world. The police raided lesbian bars regularly, and they did it. They both did it in the most obvious way, which was hauling women away in paddy wagons. But they did. There was regular weekend harassment, which would consist of the police coming in regularly to get their payoffs. And in the Sea Colony, we had a back room with a red light. And when that red light went on, it meant the police would be arriving in around 10 minutes. And so we all had to sit down at our tables. And we would be sitting there almost like school children. And the cops would come in. Now, depending on who was on, which cop was on, if it was some that really resented the butch women, who were with many times very beautiful women, we knew we were in for it, because what would happen is they would start harassing one of these women and saying, "Huh, you think you're a man? Come outside, we'll show you." And the woman would be dragged away. They'd throw up against a wall, and they'd say, "So you think you're a man? Let's see what you got in your pants." And they would put their hand down her pants.
On Friday night, June 27, 1969, at about 11:45, eight officers from Public Morals 1st Division loaded into four unmarked police cars. From their headquarters on 21st Street and 3rd Avenue, they headed downtown and then west towards the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. It was the second time the bar was raided that week. The local 6th Precinct had just received a new commanding officer who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. And New York was in the midst of a mayoral campaign, always a bad time for homosexuals. Mayor John Lindsay had good reason to agree to the police crackdown. He had just lost his party's primary and needed a popularity boost. And the Stonewall Inn was indeed an inviting target. Operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license, this dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, minors, and more masculine lesbians known as bull dykes. Many were black or Hispanic. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Moral Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting. One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out, at which time we had to chase that person, and he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door, and at that point we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon, and there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor-style hair, and she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on him. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
My name is Howard Smith. On the night of the Stonewall riots, I was a reporter for the Village Voice, locked inside with the police, covering it for my column. It really did appear that that crowd, because we could look through little peepholes in the plywood windows, we could look out, and we could see that the crowd, well, my guess was within 5-10 minutes, it was probably several thousand people. Now, 2,000, easy. And they were yelling, "Kill the cops. Police brutality. Let's get them. We're not going to take this anymore. Let's get them."
We noticed a group of persons attempting to uproot one of the parking meters, in which they did succeed. And they then used that parking meter as a battering ram to break down the door. And they did, in fact, open the door. They crashed it in. And at that point was when they began throwing Molotov cocktails into the place.
There were a couple of cops stationed on either side of the door with their pistols, like in a combat stance, aimed in the door area. A couple others were stationed in other places, behind like a pole, another one behind the bar. All of them with their guns ready. I don't think up to that point I had ever seen cops that scared.
When the Morrill Squad officers barricaded themselves inside the Stonewall, Deputy Inspector Pine put in a 1041 call, an emergency help request which can only be placed by a high-ranking officer. That call was mysteriously canceled, and the telephone inside the Stonewall went dead. It took nearly 45 minutes for the riot police to get to the Stonewall and rescue the Morrill Squad from the smoldering bar.
My name is Martin Boyce, and in 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms, like the Rockettes, and sang the song we used to sing. We are the village girls, we wear our hair in curls, we wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees. And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Rudy, and the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe.
My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian, and I guess you would label me as a butch. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen, blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks, gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there whether we were scared or not. We didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
The media covered the riot extensively. The Daily News featured it on its front page. There were reports on all the local television and radio stations. By the next day, graffiti calling for gay power had appeared on buildings and sidewalks all over the West Village. Hastily worked up flyers, distributed on street corners, touted the night as the hairpin drop heard round the world. And the next night, thousands of men and women converged on the West Village. They came here, back to the Stonewall, to see what would happen next. While trash cans were set on fire, stones were thrown, and sporadic fighting broke out between police and gays, the more than 400 riot police milling around the village ensured that the previous night's violence would not be repeated. But on this night, for the first time, gay couples could be seen walking hand in hand or kissing in the streets. Just by being there, surrounded by reporters and photographers and onlookers, thousands of men and women were proclaiming to themselves and the rest of the world that they were gay. And the crowds grew and came back the next night and for one more night the following week. What happened here on those nights helped to usher in a new era, both personally and politically, for gay men and lesbians.
My name is Jim Forat, and I'm in the mid-60s, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I was one of the founders of the Yippie movement. I remember on the third night of the riots, there was this meeting called by Mattachine Society at St. John's Church on Waverly Place. We went, and Randy Wicker was running the meeting.
For 10 years, I've been going on television as Randy Wicker, the respectable homosexual dressed in dark suit and tie, explaining to people that most homosexuals look like everybody else and behave like everybody else. And when Stonewall began happening, you had chorus lines of queens kicking their heels up at the police, bonfires burning in the corner of trash baskets and throwing bricks and stones at the police. I was horrified because this violated everything that we thought of as responsible behavior, that this was not the way respectable citizens behaved.
Evelyn Hooker was a sociologist, I believe. Randy had introduced her, and she got up, and she suggested that we should have a candlelight march, that we should turn the other cheek because gay people were really different, we were really nice, and we had to show how nice we were and stop all this rioting because people were going to get hurt. I remember I stood up, and I said, no, we are not going back. And people felt the same thing I felt. And we marched out of that room, and that was the night that the Gay Liberation Front was born.
That night, in some very deep way, we finally found our place in history. Not as a dirty joke, not as a doctor's case study, not as a freak, but as a people. Imagine myself
away from you. Remembering Stonewall was engineered by Spider Blue. It was produced by David Isay with a grant from the Pacifica National Program Fund. I'm Michael Shirker.
That was an excerpted version of Remembering Stonewall, the birth of a movement, as it aired on a Making Contact episode from 2015 hosted by Laura Flynn. The documentary was produced in 1989 and is part of the Pacifica Radio Archives. After a quick break, we'll dive into another throwback story from the Making Contact vault. Stay tuned. For the second half of today's Pride episode, we go back to 2014, when we got to visit a gay rodeo on the show.
There's only one thing left for us to say. On three, it's let's rodeo. One, two, three, let's rodeo! You got it. Thank you, Pepe. Thank you, Craze. Have a great day.
Rodeo is a part of life for many Americans. But if you're an LGBTQ rodeo fan, participating in the sport you love can mean hiding part of who you are to fit in. You don't often hear the words gay and rodeo together, but as producer Vanessa Roncagno found out, across the country, a tight-knit group of queer cowboys has found a way to live the country and western lifestyle in their own way. On this edition of Making Contact, she brings us one bull rider's story.
So my name is Jason Strand. We're at Corona Ranch in Phoenix, Arizona. And this is the first day of the Phoenix Rodeo and first rodeo of the season.
It's rodeo season again, and Jason Strand has come from the San Francisco Bay Area to be here. He's one of the very few cowboys here who still competes in the rodeo's most dangerous event, bull riding. Minutes before his first ride of the season, Jason's standing behind the chutes. They're the metal pens on one end of the arena where the crew holds the bulls before the event. The arena spreads out in front of him, surrounded by colorful wooden bleachers where some 300 fans clap and cheer. At 33, Jason's pretty young compared to most of the cowboys here. He's a small guy, blue-eyed and baby-faced, and overall seems like no match for the huge bull he's about to get on. I grabbed a cowboy in the crowd to help explain what was happening.
Jason's getting ready. He's got his chaps on. He's got his mouth guard in. He's cinching up his protective bull riding vest.
I've had my fair share of injuries.
That's Jason again.
I've been stomped on a number of times. My first full year riding, I had a bull land on my chest in Denver. Hit my chest, my shoulder, and cracked my helmet in half. Had my legs stomped on a number of times. I got gored in Chicago last year. I took a horn to my hip. That was probably my worst. I've been lucky. Any ambitions that I have, anything at all that is keeping me from concentrating on where I need to look, on my breathing, on my technique, I try to push it out of my mind. Because the slightest distraction can cost you big time.
Yeah, he's pacing back and forth a little bit. Just waiting for him to get ready for his animal.
How about a wave to your
fan? Oh, I'm sure he's nervous. We want to do so well each time, and it's 6 seconds, so it's very quick.
All right,
now he's getting over the top rail. He's straddling the animal, just getting down onto the back of it.
It's a 15 to 3,000 pound animal, and so you know, you're straddling this huge animal, and I mean, if you've ever ridden a horse, it almost feels like a saddle that just keeps moving on its own.
And there's the gates open. He's going. It's bucking. He's going out. We got a good ride.
When it bucks, you get to feel their raw power. It's like four people coming up behind you and just shoving you from the back forward. And then again from the front. It's tremendous. For a rider, you live for that buzzer. And every second feels like minutes or hours. There's a point where you start thinking, oh my God, did they not set the buzzer? And at that point, you're still fighting, you're still going with it, you're going strong, or your thoughts have gotten the best of you, and you've lost track of what you're doing, and you start to fall, and then as you start to hit the ground, you hear the buzzer, and you're going, oh.
You know, the rodeo is so many different things to so many different people. You've got the contestants, you've got the officials, you have the royalty contestants, the people competing for Mr., Ms., Mister, and so forth. You have people that come to the rodeo just to dance. You have people who come to the rodeo as vendors that are trying to sell products, many of which are LGBT focused. You have the spectators. If you want to dress in drag and perform, you can do that at the rodeo. If you want to be a bull rider, whether you're a man or a woman, you can come out and be a bull rider. You can be whatever you want, and I think that's just fantastic.
This is not professional level rodeo, right? Because that's not what we do for a living. You know, we're teachers and doctors and lawyers and courier drivers, whatever we happen to be. This is just our hobby. This is what we do, but we do it a lot.
Like any rodeo, there's roping events, speed events, and rough stock events, the ones where people get really dirty, like bull riding and steer wrestling. But there's some special competitions, too.
And the camp events are unique to gay rodeo.
Well, and they're called camp events because they're campy. Yeah. That's the whole point. They're just for fun.
And they tend to be some of the more popular events in the stands. A team of two run out, one holds the legs of a goat, the other one puts underpants on it, jockey shorts, underpants, and they race back. That's goat dressing. We have another one called steer decorating, where one person holds a steer on a lead and the second person ties a ribbon on their tail, and they both run back and hit a timer. And the third one is really popular. It's called wild drag. It's a team of three. There's a male, a female, and then a third person dressed in female attire. And they have to get the drag person up on the steer, and then they have to come back across the line with the person riding the steer back. People get into the costumes. A team has come out dressed in nun and priest attire. A couple years ago, there was a team of three who dressed up as Gone with the Wind.
And drag, Jason Strand.
Our friend Jason Strand has decided to do wild drag as well. And he is in a lovely red cotton candy matted mess of a wig and a little black tutu. Of course, in his Wranglers and his cowboy boots as well. And the cowgirls just handed off the rope to the cowboy. They're struggling to get it back across the 70-foot line. Oh, steer flipped over. That is never a good thing. Jason just fell down. That's not good. Now the two team steers are tangled. Oh, Jason just got flipped over, caught in the rope, tripped by the rope, lost his hair, and he's given up.
Gay rodeo started back in 1975 when a guy named Phil Ragsdale decided an amateur gay rodeo would be a great way to raise money for charity and break some stereotypes in the process. It was a success, and similar rodeos started cropping up across the West. The independent groups eventually got together and formed the International Gay Rodeo Association, IGRA. Gay rodeo emerged as the AIDS epidemic was starting to hit gay communities around the country. The rodeos were a safe haven that meshed gay liberation ideology with the country Western Party, and they filled a huge need.
Back in the 80s, we were getting very, very, very little support and attention and focus on what ended up being a very devastating disease for our community. My name is Steve Woolert. I live in San Diego, California. I was Mr. IGRA 2006. All of us that grew up in the Midwest or the West or on farms and ranches as we were coming of age and coming out were searching for that thing that we identified with, because it was very hard to be a gay cowboy. first time that I went to a gay rodeo and walked into a ballroom where men were dancing with men to country music. I mean, sorry. I found my home. Because there's a lot of us that grew up that way and essentially had to be completely closeted if we wanted to participate in rodeo.
I grew up in a small town on a farm, and so I've been to many rodeos, and it's very much the, you know, jeans and big belt buckles and very conservative Christian environment, and I would not have expressed myself in that venue. And I'm very open now, but I would never have dreamt. Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you were to go back home to visit, would you express yourself then?
Well, if my family would allow me to go back home and visit, then yeah. Maybe. Would you, Brian?
Well, I'm from L.A., so it's no big deal anymore.
If I had been exposed to that there are other farmers, ranchers, that were just like me and they loved what they did, it could have changed my path, most definitely.
I'm Darcy Ward, and I work the rodeo circuit. I started working it when I was still female, and then in the early 2000s, I transitioned to male. So I'm F to M, which is female to male, transgender. It's been very important to me to try to come out more and more to everybody, because there's still, even in the gay community itself, a lot of prejudice towards transgenders. And we're trying to say, hey, we're here. We're not bizarre, weird, crazy. It's just a part of who we are, and it's another part of the community to embrace. We're all dealing with the same crap, and we just want to be who we are and live our lives.
Jason's husband, Will, looks tired too. He's been in the stands all day cheering and photographing and videotaping. Will comes to the rodeos with Jason whenever he can, but he never competes. And it's clear this is Jason's thing, not his.
I'm Will Eichmann, and I am Jason Strand's husband. And we have been together for 10 years now. Jason and I met in Phoenix when we both lived here. We moved to San Francisco right before the Proposition 8 vote. We decided to get married like the weekend before the proposition because we were worried that the vote was going to go the wrong way.
Jason grew up in Reno, Nevada, where he got introduced to rodeo. But it wasn't until he moved to San Francisco that he really got into it. It took Will by surprise.
He has a friend in San Francisco that participated. He suggested, Jason, you know, come down and help out with the crew. Well, he got down there, and he was so infatuated with it, people sponsored him to enter events. You know, no cowboy gear, no nothing. You know, out there in Skechers, looked at him like, where did this come from? If you know my husband, it's not unusual. Things do come out of the blue with him. He's had the bug ever since.
They think I'm nuts. I mean, my mom, she thinks it's really cool, and she's happy that I love it. And, you know, she backs me 100%, but she thinks I'm nuts. She knows that for me, it's not just competing. It's the people. It's a very tight-knit family. And I love it now. I don't know how I went so long without doing it.
The International Gay Rodeo Association is still around, and in fact, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the gay rodeo.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Diane here. I'm the co-host of Something's Happening at Midnight on Monday through Thursday, midnight to 6 a.m., with a message from our interim general manager, Maggie DePeek. So you may have noticed some outages in our signal lately, and the reason is our transmitter is really urgently in need of some repairs. Since we're listener-sponsored, we're coming to you. The good news is a generous donor has already donated $25,000. and that will be matched by the rest of us for a total of $50,000. And then our chief engineer, Stu Landau, and longtime KPFK ally and a top radio engineer, Bert Wiener, they'll take care of the rest. We only have until July 31st, so please call that number, 818-985-5735, option 2, or kpfk.org, and click the Fix the Signal banner. Every dollar counts. Thank you in advance for your generosity, keeping us strong and on the air. Let's fix the